Ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome you once again to Poets of the East Season 2, and I am so pleased that right alongside me, my wonderful, creative, poetic friend, my brother, Misha Danduta. Misha, welcome.
Thank you very much. I'm honored, I'm happy, and I'm humbled to be here again within the second season of the Poets of the East. Thank you very much, Rick Spisak. Thank you very much for your energy. Thank you very much for your love to poetry. And thank you very much that you made existing this second season. Ladies and gentlemen, I am honored to have us main producer of this wonderful series, a great poet and a great cultural manager, Rick Spisak. Thank you, Rick.
My brother, I'm only going to ask you to promise one thing for season two. From now on, after today, I'm going to want you to bring at least one of your own fantastic poems to every one of our shows. Is that a fair deal?
I cannot say no. I'm overwhelmed. Thank you very much. It is really a great honor. And if this is a promise, yes, I will. I swear I do.
Okay. That's all I ask of you today, my brother.
Well, listen, thanks a lot.
We have two more just amazing, heart-tugging, powerful poets to bring to you today. Besides my brother, Misha Danduta. Besides
Rick Spisak, which is always the best.
You're very kind.
I mean, if you may not know him, but I know him really.
Well, you're very kind, my brother. Very kind. Okay.
I'm just joking. Okay.
You wanna say a word or two about Leslie, who's gonna be our first one up?
I'd be honored. I mean, I know Leslie Constable. I have known Leslie Constable for a couple of years. I have always been impressed with its artistic main force. I'm surprised, by the way. It was a complex dimension of its art, the final one. And I was very surprised. Sometimes I was looking at its paintings, and I was able to understand until I read its poetry, its poems. I mean, in order to understand the painting of Leslie Constable, it is important to understand its poetry, because the beauty in the color.
Unfortunately, brother, you're breaking up quite a bit. Let's hope that as time passes in the show that your connection will improve. Right now it's breaking up pretty severe. So let me go ahead and bring on part one of our dear Leslie Constable, an extraordinary poet, painter, journalist, writer extraordinaire, and I have to say, a being of some awesome spiritual consequence as well. So here we go with part one, Leslie Constable. Let's hear it from her. Hello?
Hello, can you see me?
I can see your lovely smiling face. I'm a lucky man for it.
Thank you.
How are you, my dear?
Oh, I'm great. I'm just having a fabulous day so far. How about you?
Very good, very good. Although the day is yet young, I have challenges and exciting projects ahead of me, not the least of which is your lovely self. And I've been studying a little bit from the wonderful information you sent me, And I am so pleased to know you even just a little bit, and I look forward to knowing you a little bit more.
Wonderful. Thank you.
So I'm starting my recording process now.
Okay.
And in just about a minute, I'll be able to say, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Leslie Constable, an artist, a poet, a writer, a critic, an educator, and most of all, a wonderful creative person outside all the boxes. And when I read in her bio that she feels inspired by the concept of a magical realism, that's one of the best boxes you could have, I suspect. And being a person myself who's been graced with insights, with visions, with inspiration outside the human rational box, I have to say, my gosh, I'm welcome to meet you. Leslie, so you've been an artist since you were young. Talk about your early art. What were some of the things that motivated you? What inspired you? Talk a little bit about the young Leslie.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, I have a rather mythic structure to my life.
I bet.
In itself. And I'm really more about what I do and what interests me rather than my identity and all that. I'm more curious about life and others than myself.
Sure.
So it's fine to begin with some of that. I'm a dual citizen. My father, American, my mother, English. They met during the war. Wonderful romantic story. He was injured in my mother's hometown regarding training ops to be, to go over to the European theater, as it was called. And they put him in a bed to recuperate next to my mother's British Army cousin.
How fortuitous.
Yeah, such a charming story. And so there were a lot of transatlantic crossings vis-a-vis ships that were involved. And they got engaged by mail and they were married in Bristol.
How nice.
And then, I was on the way, and my father, who was a journalist, couldn't get work in Britain after the war. And so he got a job sight unseen at a newspaper in Ohio, where he stayed for 40 years. So that involved another voyage 6 weeks before my birth. So I
had
a transatlantic voyage. They let pregnant women on ships back then that far along. So that was sort of my beginning. So yeah, a lot of fun, but I just have a lot of that sort of stuff going on. The other very odd thing about my beginnings is that I started life as a fraternal twin, and it's very rare that it happens, but it does. I've been told medically that my mother miscarried my twin brother.
Wow.
And didn't know she was still expecting. And
you were a surprise baby, huh?
So anyhow, they kept the secret. They kept it a secret. They kept it hidden from me until I turned 18. It was like, and then my father said, "Oh, we better tell her now." And I'm, "Tell me what?" They said, "You were a twin." And I went, "I know," which I did, because I had this imaginary twin friend named Timothy, who used to apparently float up and get stuck on the ceiling. And there was my very pragmatic English mother with a little step ladder trying to say, "Is he here? Is he here?" So in my British family, they're all, West Country sort of fairy folk types. And so it's like, "Oh, it's the fairy folk," all that. And so the other funny little aspect to me is that And my father was, he was a jazz musician. He was really hip.
Wow.
He was a poet. He was a painter himself, a Shakespearean scholar, blah, blah, blah. But he really loved Picasso, which some people don't. I happen to. And so right before my birth, they placed, they had Picasso prints all over the apartment. And so they placed one to the side of my crib. And,
my goodness.
And so I recall, it's like Picasso was my fairy godfather because.
Talk about imprinting. Wow, that's amazing.
And so I would stare at, and I, you know, I don't remember those early months,
sure,
you know, that early time, but then as a toddler and then a child, I would, you know, we had them all over the apartment. So I would stare at them and interpret them and that sort of thing.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
I didn't have a chance, you know.
No Frederick Remington here.
No, so yeah, and I still go to the, whenever I'm in Barcelona, I go to the Picasso Museum there and stand in front of, he did a, one day after another of homage to Velázquez's Las Meninas, or the you know, the La Infanta, that wonderful painting. And so he did huge, like almost room-sized paintings day after day of sort of breaking down that painting. And I stand, whenever I visit there and I stand in front of it, I start crying. It just, well, you know how that happens. It just is very.
Absolutely.
And so at one point I went again and the guard says to me, oh, and I speak good Spanish. He says, oh, you are the one who cries. And I took that as such a sincere compliment.
Absolutely.
And so he gave me space and, you know, and of course I started crying again, but. Picasso to me is like I said, my fairy godfather. So,
well, if you'll permit me, one of my artistic early momentous ones was I was so fortunate as a young child, the elementary school that I went to, the principal was so inspired by music. She made sure that every first or second grader got a chance to attend the great Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra in the most beautiful hall, a late 19th century building, so beautifully done. And when I went, here I am in first grade, I was so completely transported. It was a Tchaikovsky show, and I just started weeping. It was so breathtakingly, achingly beautiful that I just started crying. I was so touched. Mm. And the principal came over to me, dear woman, just the dearest woman. She said, Ricky, what's wrong? And I said, it's so beautiful. I can remember it to this day. She said, yeah, but what's wrong? And I said, it's so
nothing.
So you know what? That dear woman let me go with every class that went the entire 6 years that I attended that school. I got to go with every group that went because she knew that this meant something very, very special.
Oh, bless her. She understood. Oh, how wonderful.
What a launch. What a launch. So I got a chance to play. I began trumpet 2 years ahead of my peers because I just had to play trumpet. I was touched by these two films, the biopic of George Gershwin's life, which is, I gather now, much irrelevant to what his really experience was, but the Gershwin biopic and then the Vic Spiderbeck biopic called A Man with a Horn. So I started playing trumpet early, but enough about me. My dear Leslie, so you've been both a graphics person, it seems to me, as well as a writing person. So when did you really begin to know that you really didn't have a choice. You were a writer and a teacher, I might add.
Well, my mother had to get a lot of advice from all the West Country folk in terms of how to manage me. And they just said, well, she's just one of those. The fairies were present at her birth. They handed out a lot of stuff to her. So, and she was always on the phone because on the phone or writing letters, because she just didn't get it. And So anyhow, one of them was like stick crayons in her hand.
Excellent.
Give her something to do. And I lived grew up across from this remarkable estate called Black's Woods in Mansfield, Ohio. And Mrs. Black, a very wealthy woman, gave me free run or free reign over her woods. And I built little forts under the juniper trees, and she had a stable, you know, and so I got to see the foals when they were born and blah, blah, blah. So I had a lot of help. And also there were a lot of elderly neighbors around us. And Mansfield, Ohio was like a settlement center, probably like Pittsburgh or a lot of the, the industrial areas, you know, in the United States. But it was a settlement center after World War II. So my whole graduating class, we were like citizens of the world. I mean, they were either born somewhere else, moved when they were tiny, or they were, you know, just their families had come over and they were born in the United States. I was just one of many of first generation of whatever on one side. And so it was just a real, you know, amazing environment to grow up in. And all the elderly neighbors around my house spoke other languages. I guess I spoke German, so that Mrs. Hunsinger would give me cherry strudel. And I was the little kid who went and visited all the elderly neighbors, and I had very good manners, and I loved to listen to their stories, and I loved their company. So that was another thing that, you know, I was sort of given to do, and my curiosity about how other people were. And then going and visiting my friends, at their houses, in many cases that the parents didn't speak good English at all, you know. And so that the kid was the interpreter. And so I got to see all the artwork on their walls and, you know, taste and smell their cooking and taste it. And it was all different. And so I think that amplified everything too. I guess I don't know where I'm going with this, but.
It's okay. Yeah. It was a lovely voyage. By the way, I lived in Massillon, Ohio in 52. No, it's a 53, 54.
Massillon. Oh, I absolutely know where that is. Totally. Excellent. Moving on. I think that, and my dad was a writer. He was a poet himself. He had an amazing library. We talked in my family, we talked about art. My mother was a good dancer. I ended up also as a modern dancer at one point. And so I went to symphony.
Now, may I ask?
Ballet.
Hmm? Merce Cunningham, Isadora Duncan. Whose dance captured you?
Thanks for saying Merce Cunningham. I actually, when I was cutting my teeth as an arts writer, I did a lot of dance reviews, and I had the honor, privilege of seeing Merce Cunningham perform with John Cage, his pal.
Oh.
And I wrote about it. So I have the review somewhere.
Oh, that's wonderful. That must have been, well, I'm sure it's quite memorable.
Right. But then I was an Ohio State girl, and I ended up teaching there and, you know, being an art curator there, blah, 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 blah. But wow, what amazing. You know, I saw Twyla Tharp. I saw Alvin Ailey, Paul Taylor, all the greats of dance.
And as a dancer, wonderful.
And a writer, I was able to write because my body knew what was going on. I was able to write about dance in a very, very simple way, so that, you know, in non-technical terms, so the reader could pretty much follow along. But, and then, you know, all the, you know, the political people Luis Borges and I can't even remember all of them. I interviewed Madeleine L'Engle, the writer who, if you recall her, Mrs. What's It and Who's It, and I forget, A Wrinkle in Time, I interviewed her. I interviewed Yoko Ono. I have a tape of, yeah, I did.
What was your first impression?
Of Yoko Ono?
Sure.
How amazingly gracious she is as a being.
You know, a lot of people had just tremendous trouble finding appreciation in her vocalizations, in her musical work. I never had that problem. My taste run from avant-garde through the classics and beyond. I was a very, very late comer to rock and roll. I didn't really begin to appreciate it until probably at least the late 60s, early 70s. I was a jazz and classical artist. I had no use for pop music whatsoever.
And I get it.
Until I heard Jim Morrison and Frank Zappa, I went, okay, maybe there's something there that can speak to me. But I so totally appreciate it. And I remember sitting at parties in the late 60s, early 70s, when the double side came on, there was John and there was the Yoko side, and my friends were just holding their ears and yelling. And I said, wait a minute. Yes, it's not melodic, but that's okay. Can you, give yourself a minute to listen? I like her work. I like her work tremendously. Now, I love John's work, especially the political stuff. I had no use for their 60s early stuff, that want to hold your hand crap. But,
yeah,
but,
or Love Me Do. That
yeah, All not that my mountain. Cup of tea. But the political stuff, absolutely. So let's talk for just a moment or two about what it was like, young artist, binational, as we walk through the Vietnam War years. Very interesting time for artists.
Absolutely. Well, I had a lot of fun.
Nice answer. And if you want to leave it at that, I understand, because it was a complicated time.
No, I had oodles of fun, and I saw Hendrix and Cream and the Animals, and I saw the Beatles. August 14th, 1966, I did.
No kidding. Okay.
And I saw Airplane, then later Starship. I got my job as an arts writer after I graduated from J school, journalism school. I got my job because of Paul Kantner.
No kidding.
Starship. I'll tell you the story real quick. It's like,
the editor
is like, all right, well, let's see if you got what it takes. You know, my dad was a journalist. I love those guys. It's like, you put the story to bed yet? Like, get so-and-so on the horn. You know, those just gravelly voices, just hilarious. I loved all of them. Curmudgeons, all of them. But so he said, I'll tell you what, he says, I've got two tickets to the Starship concert. He says, here they are. Go cover it. Here's a pass to get into the dispatch, up on the sixth floor, there'll be computers, file your copy. And if you do a good job, you got the job.
So
had my two tickets to ride, show up at the concert, right? And got some good seats there. Well, took a friend with me. And so, back in the day, the Angels, the Hells Angels, used to police the concerts. They were in the first 2-3 rows. So, I've got, my when I saw Airplane in 68, obstreperous person that I am, I... I toddled up all by my lonesome and and placed my elbows on the stage and was taking pictures, and I felt this tap on my shoulder. I look around, there's this big, I love the Hell's Angels. They were looking out for me and my girlfriends all the time to make sure that, you know, we were, you know, they called us little ladies, you know, that was real sweet. So I love the Hell's Angels. So I look up and there's this big, big Hell's Angel, and he's like, you gotta sit down. And I look back and I said, look, I paid my tickets same as you, and I'm just going to take a few pictures and then I'll sit back down. And my friends were cringing because they thought, my male friends were cringing because they thought they were going to get creamed, you know, by
these guys.
And took the photo, sat back down. And then on the break, you know, I was walking around the mezzanine, and this guy comes up to, starts heading towards me. And my male friends are going, oh my God, we're going to get creamed. And he comes, he goes like, sorry, little lady. You know, it was just, we were policing it. And I just thought that, you know, I'm real apologizing.
Wow. I hope you included that in the article, an apology from Hell's Angels.
Yeah, no,
wow.
No, so this was in 68. So fast forward to like early 80s and I see Starship. So man, those guys and I have this connection. So here I am covering the thing to try to get the job, right? And so Paul starts getting upset with security, and it was what venue was it in Columbus, Ohio? I think Vets Memorial. There we go.
Can I interrupt just for a second?
Sure.
I'm curious, journalist to journalist, was your plan to cover the music, the performance, or both?
Well, nice question. I was supposed to review the performance. Okay. This was that. That was the gig it was. It was to review the performance. And so
I apologize.
Oh no, no problem. But you know, you had your little, back in the day, you had your little reporter's notebook that supposedly sit in the palm of your hand. I've got a small hand, so it, you know. And then you had, I had to fashion how my little finger worked so I didn't write over what I'd already written in the DAR.
Right.
So here I am taking notes, and Paul keeps getting upset because the security people are telling the fans to get out of the aisles and sit back down in their seats. And Paul keeps stopping and going like, look, there are fans. It's cool that they're, you know, in the aisles and dancing. You know, it's sort of part of the, you know, the Haight-Ashbury, you know, that whole
thing. Yeah.
And he started getting really upset. And then the guard jumped up on the stage. For whatever reason, I don't think anybody knew, and sort of wanted, you know, was giving Paul attitude about this. Well, Paul took his guitar and kabombed him.
Holy smokes!
The dude dropped to his knee.
Wow.
Dropped.
Wow.
All hell broke. Then they had called the police, and a line of about 10, you know, car, blah, blah, 10 cops came on the stage. You know, completely shut it down. So there I'm like, story here. And so I get up and I've got my little press pass thing on. So I got backstage, and because they couldn't find Paul, but they shut the concert down. And so I interviewed Gracie Slick, and I swear to God, I heard that, bless her heart, I heard that she was a heavy drinker, but this confirmed it, because I swear to God, if somebody had lit a match, we both would have. Right? but then I interviewed Marty Balin, who died a few years ago. I was a big fan of Marty's, and they were like, well, we don't know what happened to him. And so anyhow, one of them sort of winked at me and said, I think he might be in the bus. And so I sort of went back to the bus. I interviewed cops, blah, 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 blah. So I got back to the news.
What a great story.
Yeah, and so I did the review. And so, you know, I was
I'm sorry, don't, please, you go back to the bus.
I go back to the bus and I try to look. I sort of tapped on the door and all the roadies were sort of grinning at me. And I said, look, guys, I'm a fan. I'm not going to rat Paul out. What are you kidding me? You know? And so it was like really, really fun. And you know, everybody was sort of circling the wagons to protect Paul, you know. I'm sure he was in there. They'd hidden him somewhere. But anyhow, they never found him and it all got dropped or whatever. So anyhow, I go back to the newsroom and I'm going, how do I approach this? Okay, I'm going to do a straight review.
Right, before. TikTok, yep.
Yeah, what you know, that was what I was hired for. But I'm going to do a sidebar of like a breaking news story. And it got featured. The editor was really happy for me and for what I did. And I got the job. Thank you, Paul.
Very good. Very good.
Anyhow, I sort of digressed, but anyhow, it was, you know, I had a lot of fun. And then later on, I was made art critic. You know, this is down the road a bit.
Sure.
It was a lot of fun. And then when Yoko had released John's drawing as lithographs and had released them worldwide to various amounts of, you know, galleries here, there, and everywhere. One of them was in Columbus, Ohio, so it was my church. And so it's like, great, you know, I put it on the docket that I was going to review it. And I said to my editor, a woman I really had a lot of respect for, I'd like to interview Yoko Ono. And she said, why would you want to do that? She's the bitch who broke up the Beatles. And so I went, she said, well, do what you want. And so,
I can live with that.
And so I endeavored to find the connection and I had to get permission, blah, blah, blah. And they said, we'll let her know that you're interested. And I said, can I record it? And they said, sure, and all that. And then they said, but call back, in a couple days at this time and we'll tell you if you've been granted permission. I found out later that her system with all this, because journalists have given her such a hard time.
Oh, the poor thing, my God.
It was terrible. So she had, of course, with a little bit of trepidation about journalists, right? And I'm like, tell her I'm a fan of hers. I have her blue album and, you know, and so, anyhow, I found out later from people sort of in the know that time period was because she consulted her psychic.
Well, she was very big in that universe, very much so, yeah.
Yeah, and so I have to say that I was psychically approved.
Hey, the universe said it was cool, so hey, you're in.
Wonderful. She was so cool. And the other thing is she told me little stories. I'll send you the tape if you want to hear
it. Oh, I'd love to hear it. Oh, absolutely. That's such a gift. Thank you.
But yeah, she said we talked about her voice. We talked about her a lot because, you know, as an artist, I knew who she was.
Yeah.
And so
quite an artist in her own right before John. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so we talked about, she even mentioned like the B-52s that she thought she was influential. And remember the song Rock Lobster, you know,
uh-huh.
Yeah. So anyhow, yeah, no, I had a real cool time. I just, and the 60s, oh man, I couldn't have had more fun if I had tried, and I tried to have fun, but I did a lot of cross country road trips, east to west. And I still love road trips. I've done now.
Let me ask you one more question in your critic hat.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the rock shows, of all the rock bands you wrote about, which one sticks out the most? Which one either impressed you or disappointed you the most? Which one surprised you the most? Just one. Just, I'm sure that's hard to do, but.
It's hard to do. I covered a lot of blues, too. Because I love blues, and my first boyfriend was a blues guitarist, so I was their manager.
Good for
you. Got him gigs and stuff. Anyhow, but I have to say, and this is going to seem really odd, Coco Taylor.
She's very.
Did you know she lived?
Yeah.
So yeah, blues singer. I was really impressed with her. I mean, you know, of all the, I saw so many greats.
Sure, sure.
In terms of soul, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Coco Taylor comes to mind. Jay Giles put on a good show too.
Uh-huh.
But, well, Starship just, I mean, that rocked it. So that just stands out. But
Blows Against the Empire as Airplane and their Starship stuff was top notch, just top notch. I had a chance to see him a couple times myself. And,
oh, did you?
Oh, wow. Yeah. Oh, yeah. In fact, I got to see a lot of bands that when they were just starting out, I worked for a concert company as production manager, sound engineering, lighting design, staging, logistics, all that stuff. I staged a lot of people. One of my favorite stories was we had Bobby Blue Bland and B.B. King for a double night. Okay. But before that, one of my real favorite blues shows, we called it the Night of Three John Stars. We had John Hammond, John Lee Hooker, and Dr. John.
Whoa.
And I came up with a gimmick that as each John hit the stage, I lowered a brilliant star of sequins and hit it with a blue spot. So by the end of the night, I had three blue stars up there, and each one, you know, very different styles. But every one of them was just magnificent. But I was going to tell you a B.B. King story. This is so funny. I worked for a concert company that was a not-for-profit, okay? And consequently, there was a lot of things that we did at any rate. At one point, the very last night of planning before the show, the young lady who did PR said, "I've got this great idea. Let's draw a ticket number that night at the show and somebody can get their picture taken with B.B. King." Well, I wasn't thrilled with that because I think that a lot of times cute little white people impose on major stars to no end. And it's often, if it's not fully insulting, it's just this side of insulting. And I said, please, no, look, we're paying them. They're working hard. They're artists, you know, don't give them a little space. Let them have just that little bit of dignity. Please, no, it wasn't going to happen. Okay, so first part, before the show starts, B.B. King's manager, who was a charming fellow, New Orleans to the get, derby, cane, vest, bag of gree, he comes out to me and he says, "Now, Richard, who's going to take care of me?" I said, "Well, that gentleman over there, that's the producer, and he'll have the money at the end of the night, and he'll take care of you." He said, No. "Who's going to take care of me?" And I said, "Well, let me explain something. I'm the technical manager, technical producer. I cover all bases, but there's two things I don't do. I don't procure women or drugs. I don't do it. But anything other than that, I'm your man." He said, "Now look, this is Miami. Who's going to take care of me?" I said, okay. All right, the guy over there with the leather bag, I think he'll have anything you need. So B.B. played the fastest blues that night either. Now,
he was a cool guy, you know, don't you think?
A wonderful guy, absolutely wonderful guy. And they suffered imposition quite nicely, very generous of them. The other thing was we had a double show. Bobby Blue Bland, B.B. King, Bobby Blue Bland, B.B. King, with a break in the middle to change audience, right? So our schedule was very tight. It was a union hall. We had to get in and get out and get done, do on the next. So I warned the PR gal. I said, "Listen, if we're going to do this, I mean, if you absolutely have to do your little drawing and have a little nice person go back there with B.B. and get his picture taken, that's all well and good, but it's got to be done in time. I'm time critical." So I said, "I'll give you a 20-minute warning, a 15-minute warning, a 10-minute warning, a 5-minute warning, and then we got to go. There's no spare time." So I send my guy, gives her the 20-minute warning, gives her the 15-minute warning, gives her the 10-minute warning, the 5-minute warning. She's not there. So I turned to BB's orchestra and said, "Go. You're on." So they get out there and they're tearing into a very lively Big Band Blues. Okay, BB's in the wings, they're ready to go. Here comes the PR gal. Why'd you let them start? I said, there's this thing called time, see? And like, we had to go. She goes, oh no, you gotta stop them. So I turned to the producer, her boyfriend. I said, listen, we don't have time for this. I gave him the warnings. She missed the warnings. It's time. They're on, man. They're on. He said, Rick, can't you stop them? And I said, sure. So I walk out. Yeah, there's like 20-piece blues orchestra tearing up the stage. I said to the band director, the music director, I said, listen, we have an emergency announcement we have to make. He stops the orchestra in full tear. Here comes PR gal. Hi, we're going to draw a card. Now, so Johnny and Mary can come backstage during the break. And now the picture taken. I didn't make any friends that show.
Wow, what an experience, though, that you did that. How many years were you doing that? That's amazing.
I did it for a little more than 12 years.
Oh, wow.
Oh, some amazing things. One other
what
story I'll tell you real quick.
Privilege. Oh, no, this is great. I just can't believe that. Oh, what a
three-day jazz and blues festival. The closing day, I got John Mayall up on the stage.
Oh,
on
John
Mayall. And I got five stages going, right? So I've got stage managers on each one. I'm bopping from stage to stage, depending on whatever the problem is needed. And I get a call from the Mayall stage. They go, Rick, you got to come over here right away. And I said, okay, now also this is 83, 84. Miami is Miami Vice right now, okay? A lot of skiing going on. A lot of
skiing.
I said, what's the problem? He said, well, John Mayall's got a fifth of whiskey and a gun. He's waving him on the stage. And I go, okay, I'll be right there. So I buzz over to the stage. George Ween from the Ween, big North Sea Jazz Festival and Newport Jazz is backstage. And my stage manager is a black gentleman. He has white. He's like, man, I'm not going anywhere near that. And I said, I understand. I'll do it. So I walked up in the wings. I said, John. And he looks over and I said, John, look, this is Miami. They shoot first and ask questions later. Put the gun down. And he went, oh, yeah, okay. So he brings me the gun.
Oh, my God. It reminds me of that Talking Heads. What's that? Put away that gun. This party's simple.
Well, that was part one with Leslie. And as you could hear, she is such an amazing person. Misha, you had a couple more things you were going to say about Leslie before we got disrupted a little bit.
Well, I hope the connection will be more continuous this time.
You sound marvelous.
I hope it remains like this. Because, in Romanian trains, you never know. Nevertheless, I was so happy and so honored to listen to the poetry of Leslie and to her wonderful speech. And actually, it was the first time in my life I was more or less live with her and directly with her poetry. And this helped me a lot with understanding, on one hand, her literary creation, on the other, her plastic art creation. And I got much more convinced and much understood even better and more than one without the other is not possible to understand, is not possible to interpret. Because now a third dimension intervened, that means herself, life, her wonderful spirit, her wonderful life experience. And all this completed this wonderful impression of an equilateral triangle consisting in her life experience, her life intervention, her literary the literary dimension of her creation, and the plastic dimension of her creation. I am happy, proud, and privileged to have had the opportunity of being in contact with her wonderful creation, and I wish her a lot of good luck with everything she is going to do since now. Leslie Constable, good luck, congratulations, and all the best. Bless you.
Well, now we're going to hear part two. We're actually getting around to getting her to recite some of her work. So here we go, part two, Leslie Constable. Thank you again, Misha. As always, an erudite, insightful analysis. Here we go with Leslie.
Thanks again.
Enough about me. Let's then talk. Okay, so you've been writing professionally as a journalist and as an art critic. I'm sure that pen of yours is also going a little wild. Talk about your early performance days as a poet.
Oh, okay. So, hey, you know, historically, there are many examples of art critics who, when they stop doing that, because it's an intense job and eventually every art critic stops doing it, it's a really cool job. By the way, it's really cool that they become poets. There are many examples of that. So you just get used to the rhythm, and writing about art flushes. It's wonderful.
And you grew up with Mozart beside your bed, your crib.
No,
I mean, my God. Picasso. I'm sorry.
So it's just luscious. It's luscious. And you know, it's like, they're paying me to do this, really? Well, yeah, I bet you felt the same way about,
sure,
I'm getting paid to do this. It's my passion. I just love it so much. So, so I moved away from Columbus, Ohio, because I had been in academia too long, and it was just time to, I've been, you know, really embroiled and, you know, in the arts community and love the hell out of it, but it was just time to be quiet and do something else, be very private. So moved out to Santa Fe, New Mexico, just amazing place. And, you know, I did write occasionally for the Santa Fe New Mexican about art. That was cool. But I had this place called the Aztec Street Cafe. And I've got four kids. And so I dropped them off at school, and my habit was to sit in the Aztec Street Cafe. And I was used to writing, so I started writing like a maniac, just writing poems, and they just poured out of me. And it was an amazing, rich period for me. And also, I had teenagers, and I was sort of crash pad kids. You know, a lot of them just stayed at my house. I'd wake up in the morning and I'd be picking my way across the body on the living room, making my way to the kitchen to make, you know, put on the coffee pot. And this one friend of my son's, Lex Wensberg, used to smell the coffee and get up and sit with me. And we would chat, drinking coffee, while I was writing poems. And, you know, at the same time, so the multitasking. And he'd say, let me see it. And bless him, he was, what, 15? What an amazing critic he was. And what a wonderful, like, poetry companion. He was, like, my biggest fan, and he encouraged me. Isn't that cool?
Very much so.
And so, anyhow, fast forward. So I decided to go down to Mexico. Lots of reasons. I took Spanish in high school and had visited Mexico early on in the way early 70s. And took off to Mexico with the plans to find a place down there and live, which I eventually did. And ended up, down in this little village called Sayulita, Nayarit, Mexico. And moved down there, and my youngest went to school there, and he's back up in Santa Fe now, but he speaks flawless Spanish because he went to school in the Mexican school, not the gringo school, speaking Spanish. Anyhow, so I cut my teeth at Bar Don Paso in the Plaza of Sayulita, Nayarit, Mexico, at the open mic that is a really hip town, a lot of internationals and a lot of musicians. The music was just fab. And so they started doing this open mic, and I thought, I know, I'll get up and read. But I found really quickly that, to sign up to be early, because once people start really hitting the bottle and really drinking, you don't want to be reading poems to them. Not that they were disrespectful. It's just that they couldn't focus. And anyhow, so that's how I cut my teeth as a performance poet, is which I sort of call myself, because, man, if you can read to like a bilingual crowd, in a Mexican club,
that's awesome.
Everything happened. Everything that could happened. And it was important to have good peripheral vision to duck. My favorite story, though, is when I read this poem called The Summer of Love, which you might have heard it the other night. But I have made pals really easily. I love everybody, and I especially love people younger than me, because they're really cool. And sat down with this kid guy in his 20s, whatever, and he was like, he kept saying like, oh yeah, The Summer of Love, 1969. I'm like, what are you talking about? And he said, well, why are you getting that from? It was 1967. He goes, no, it was 69. I'm like, what are you arguing with me? I was there. And he says, the Gap. You know, the Gap had this whole line of clothes called 1969. I went, I said, what? I mean, come on, dude. I said, I'll tell you what. You know, I'm gonna write you a poem about 1967. And so you'll know. I'll just give it to you straight. So the next week I got up with the mic and I started reading Summer of Love. And in the middle of it, I decided I was going to sing Somebody's Love, in homage.
You did it beautifully the other day, by the way.
Oh, thank you. So yeah, you heard this story. So then anyhow, in the middle of summer, singing Somebody's Love, I'm facing the audience, and behind me is the plaza. And suddenly I'm realizing that I'm hearing all these voices behind me in the plaza, and I sort of like turn around and look, and there are all these Mexicans singing Somebody's Love. It was a happening, it was really a lot of fun. So yeah, that's how I cut my teeth. And I put on some events, I would put on some reading events, and I knew all the other poets in town. We sort of bonded together, and it was just such a supportive and fun, hip place. And I had a lot of fun with it. But, eventually I wanted to come back here to the UK. I do live in the US sometimes, because I want to be near my kids there. Even though they visited a lot in Mexico, but I came here to be amongst people who, their first language is English, and the way, especially the Brits, and I grew up, understanding and Brit speak real well, all the patter and all the weird phrasing and stuff. So it's really a delight to be around those who, English is their first language. And to be part of the internet now, the international community, especially with what Dear David Seurat provides, Spoken World, and a lot of the other hosts. It's just, isn't it the most amazing, enriching experience? I mean,
find it so beautifully ironic that as we all have been in isolation, These new poet connections, these new writing connections have flourished across the globe. And we are linked up to poets, from Sri Lanka to Bangladesh to India to Vienna. to Prague to Budapest.
Beirut. Yeah, everywhere.
It's so wonderful. And it is, you know, poetry is so, I think, undervalued in the West so much, and at least in America. And to find that we're building these bridges in a world they don't even know, you know,
right.
And poets have reached out and found our common hearts. It's so beautiful.
Isn't it, though? No, I just feel so. And the irony of in these times with the pandemic and that it almost feels like, you know, we're holding the light or something. And, you know, we're helping to provide a beacon, I think, because so many of the poems have been about our experience now, and to be able to share these experiences and ourselves. And I think poets in, from, you know, any culture, any generation, we are the chroniclers. Then in an interview, I love the Paris Review. Once, I forget which poet was interviewed, but he was talking about poetry, and he says, well, poetry is simply a prayer. And I love that. I love the simplicity of it. And, you know, it's, here we are. You know, we're the chroniclers of our time.
Exactly. In fact, I have made the argument many times that what are the oldest stories we know? We know the stories of poets.
Yeah.
The ballads.
Yeah.
The chroniclers. Now, obviously, this is the perfect segue to hear some of the amazing, fantastic poetry of Miss Leslie Constable. Please,
okay.
Among those wonderful pieces of yours, let's hear some of your favorites. Let's hear maybe something new that you don't even trust yet. I don't know. My dear.
Oh, I'm doing that all the time. I'm
the
like,
floor is yours.
I'm spewing them out. All right. The first one is a favorite of mine, and it's about, and I read this at the at Bar Don Pato, and it's about writing poetry. It's called The Seeded Cloud. The thoughts that come to you, come into your head and rumble round, the snake insidious, the ones, you know these thoughts, the ones that have shape, their own substance and form, image, even music that cannot be given voice. Never that, because this asks too much, like clouds forming and shifting, disappearing and reforming. They are yours, fragile, inside the workings of your mind, like when the sun hits cloud, fragile. They are amorphous, unheard, and deeply, deeply private. These ghosts of thought, your ghosts of ideas that form, wanting birth, yet hide, wanting, yet hide, waiting, and want, and wait. And jeer sometimes these phantoms that cannot stand up to the proof of considered thought, that cannot stand up to language, that cannot exist in the light of day, but only in containment. Is that what your life is? Is that who you are? No one knows but you. They are the formation, your thought. Of clouds. They are the beginning. They are the seed, clouds becoming rain, or the easy words you say, words without clouds when the sun is right up there bold and over hot in the sky, even though you are in shadow, these words you say, forming them with your mouth, your tongue, your lips. Is this you? We can falsify, we can deny, we can withhold, hold deep into us those truths which have no form but only words, or which have only form and not words, or words that won't form and wait until forever, where the true thoughts override them with chit-chat, with the mundane, the inane. But there is that moment, yes, when the weight of necessity, the weight of insistence, the weight of our own truth, the need to get these damn things out of our heads and finally, deeply say, speak, talk, write, scream, get out, get out, get out, shape, the constructs, the towers, the rivers, the pyramids, our islands, the bridges, explode them all and talk, write, be, make the bridge, fuse them, private ideas, public talk. You are the seeded cloud. You are the rain. Make us all wet.
Beautiful. Thank you so much, Leslie.
This one is homage to my beloveds, my dear children, my four children. And it's a real private moment, I think, as a parent. It's called While You Were Sleeping. While you were sleeping, I was awake watching. While you were asleep, I was awake waiting for you to wake. And I waited and watched sometimes, checking for signs, the chest rising and falling slowly. Yes, he is breathing. Yes, she breathed. The movement of the eyes behind closed lids, rapid and slow, to repeat this patterns of dreams as they arise behind the eyes, beneath translucent eyelids, the color of flesh, your flesh, like a pearl, glowing, and the small whimpers, the singing, the short barks as you dream, the symbols of sleep, awakening, waking, awake. I've watched you as you sleep and know them all. I know you. You remained asleep. You did not stir, and me, my hands forming the ancient signs, the meaning of these deep in the body, sleeping still. These caves of desire asleep, and in sleep, waking, the chill, dark, still, calm desire, the breath of desire, the chest moving in response to the signals of behind the eyes, up and down the chest, aging in increments as I watch. Constant as love, we wait. Together in the sky, strung like pearls to form a necklace in the sky, nearly imperceptible, the hint, the dark glimmer at night of these orbs shining separate, yet together, except when there is the moon up there, which, like us, shines like the moon. We are the moon, each our own that shine. Sleep, my love, my precious one. I will not wake you before your time. I will not wake you with my own tremors of fear or of rage which shake me, for they are my own, mine to own, she who is wakeful. While you were growing, I was grown, a tree with roots which go down to the middle of earth, my mind spiraling up now as branches passing through the reaches and there up into the darkened sky. While you were sleeping, I traveled there, up high, and forgot myself and you. I forgot you, remembering me, and I forgot I was awake and you asleep, and forget myself, and simply kept going, wakeless or not, wakeful or not, I forgot, and imagined me, the baby this time, once again, sleeping as I was, and I will be again, wakeless, wakeful, weightless, in dream, in memory, I simply kept going.
Beautiful.
I've got some short ones, so yeah.
Listen, I have no problem. Please, my dear, as you're given.
Okay, this one is. I live near the sea. That's sort of what I do. Right now, I'm in Weymouth, Dorset, and so the sea's just right out there. This one's called The Sea Will Take You. And this had something to do with sort of a tragedy. I was living in Clacton-on-Sea, which is on the East Coast, on the North Sea, actually. And it can be very fierce. And went down to walk on the front, and there was a whole bunch of yellow tape. And I asked the police, and they said, somebody washed up. So I wrote this as a response. The sea will take you, because the sea is dangerous, you know. It's you've got to be mindful. The sea will take you if you swim past the rocks. Will it give you back? When you enter, how will it be with this, the agreement you have struck to surrender and now be one with this body large and vast and your body small? Do you know in this joy of submersion, the light play and sometimes fierce of the water having you, what it will do? In taking you, waters decide moving you? Will the sea decide? With taking you and taking you, is that what you will allow? Or in your entering, surrendering to it in some way, do you decide? In going and being taken, where would that be and how far will you go? Do you know? To know we are small when we enter the waters is that which is hidden from you, from us, your smallness, not something you can know. It is how it is and always has been this way. It is a pack drawn up, that moment of entry, the cells of each body vast with body small, the body and body now joined and in movement. The shrieks of joy with the shock of water and surprise emitting from your throat that rivals the roar of waves and you sing together the fierceness of life celebrating. If the sea takes you, will it give you back?
Bravo, bravo.
Very so nice. Thank you. This next one is about my experience in New Mexico, which is a very magical place. I'll read it. It's about the experience of driving at night. If the darkness does not see the light, it was traveling at night that we crossed down into the desert, the still cold, a gentle slap of awakeness. You can see clearly in the desert at night the distances, the spaces near to you and far off, quiet yet alive. You drive and see sometimes things that are not there or maybe there. It doesn't matter. If you keep driving, you forget after a while of everything. It's the stillness of it in the moment, the capture of thought in a way to make it go on forever, the inner dialogue that loud in your ear, your head, your being that you think you are hearing it, the you inside of you, the you outside of you at the same time. You are not hearing the echo of self in the high desert, like Sister Coyote when she yips to signal to the others, or when she sings to herself, or when she sings to the moon, or nothing at all. That is not what you are hearing, the you inside of you, the you that you are hearing. You are not. It is a sense beyond hearing. Coyote knows when she hears the echo of herself in the canyon, the sound bouncing off stone and coming back to her, she is simply being in the desert at night under the moon. What you see is not what is before you, but something else. What you hear is something else. It is the way of things at night in the desert. It is okay that you do not know. If the darkness does not see the light, does it know it is dark?
Very nice, very nice.
Well, I've just got some real short ones, I think, that I want to end up with. I tend to want to write epic things, but as things have come around, I'm sort of enjoying smaller things, simple things.
May I read one for you?
Oh, yes, please.
I was so taken by your poem about the children that it reminded me of the one I wrote for mine and a tribute I wrote to mothers. I've had the good fortune and blessings to have three children, and I had the extraordinary experience of my wife and I decided after a very, very bad experience with the medical profession to have our first at home
with
midwives. Good. And it really, I think no man should make love to a woman unless they've experienced what it's like to see a woman giving birth. Because if that doesn't give you some respect for women, I don't know what does. But that being said, I think you as a woman know exactly what I'm talking about. So I wrote this, a small tribute to mothers, because I think it is such a grace.
Yeah.
Okay. It's called The First Gifts. Yes, you welcomed those babes at your breast, gave them from your own life sustenance, thought first of them, their pleasure, their pain, their need, then some other, then yourself. You brought them through the most holy, sacred gate they will ever enter, into the world and into a human life. It can be readily said, you gave them the first gift. Before the gods at the cradle round bestowed those precious others, you clothed them in flesh. You gave them their first form. What cells and man and fashion could give, you gave first. Before your gift, there was nothing. And your giving self made every other giving possible. When the first cry is heard, it calls your name. When each searching hand first reaches out, it reaches out for you. When you press those tiny lips to your breast and smell those first tender breaths, that sweet garden scent is meant for you alone. As tiny fingers first begin the long, lonely search, they search first for you. Never is this new being more beautiful than when seen with your eye. Never is the kind of blessing given than that given from your eye and your heart. No wonder Mother is so universally blessed. No wonder such special blessedness belongs first and last to mothers. She has given so much of her flesh and her heart, the first gifts.
Well, that is so profound. It's so beautiful.
Thank you.
I'm tearing up. It's
Thank
really
you.
Beautiful. That's like the perfect, really perfect poem. Oh, my God. Is that going to be in your collection?
Oh, it is. It is.
Oh, my God. It's so perfect.
Thank you.
What's the title again, please?
The First Gifts.
Yeah, of course. Oh, my God. Oh, Rick, it's so beautiful. Wow.
Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Whew.
Mm. Okay. One other one I would love to share with you, if the gods will grace me to find it. It's called Each Morning's Cup's Blessing. After I'm granted a return today, I pour water from the sacred stream into a pot where coffee is brewed. I take the brown bean, the sweet, the bitter, the spicy, so like the moments of life, precious, darkly rich with flavor, brewing them with the heat of life. And each day, one by one, I drink one day from my Holyoke cup and think of my darling summer. And the next morning from my Jan Hus cup and think of my darling meadow. Each wonderful giving cup of life and love, small containers of the incredible rich brew of life's bracing flavor. Each morning, my ritual brings me just a kiss away from these lovely girls I've had a small part in bringing to the flavors of this richly brewed life. And cycling from one cup on one morning and another cup the next, I drink from love and love. My morning coffee, another small kiss from the rich brewed life to these small gifting cups of my darling daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And each morning, as my lips kiss these cups, drinking the rich flavors, I bless these girls, these women who have brought such rich flavor to my little life. I love you both. I thank you both. And with each morning's coffee cup, I kiss your rich life, thanking the sea and the sky and the river of life for allowing me to love you and to share these small draughts of the flavor of love and life. I love my daughters and drink life's rich brew to them each morning, to you and you, whether near or seeming far, just a draught and a lips kiss away with love.
Wow. Oh, that's wonderful.
Thank you.
You just create such an atmosphere such a place to enter. It's really magical.
Thank you.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Wow.
My dear, if you want to share one or two more, we'd be very, very thrilled to hear them.
Okay. Yeah. So I think I'll do being as bird.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
Do you think if I were a bird, I would not answer, sworn to silence, a pact of only circling above? And yes, what if I circle as in the habit of wings? Is it only you to be there above, looking down and down? Is it not mine too, the looking to see even the smallest of fruit there, hidden in the branches, that which is hidden from sight when we are on the... It is mine. It is mine. It is mine, this looking, this fruit, being as bird.
Lovely. I can see fluttering wings and that light, airy, you know. Where we live now, we have such a just a bounty of birds.
Oh, you're so lucky.
we get to hear birds singing. My wife has set out, probably 8 different bird feeders across the yard, and we are constantly hearing songs. It's such a lovely experience. It's like living in a park of birds. It's really lovely.
That's wonderful. Yeah. My poems, I tend to see that the patterns there, it's like there are many birds, lots of clouds, the sea. So, blah, blah, blah. But birds are right up there, aren't they?
Let's leave this on a spiritual note, because I think you're such a woman of spirit. Of the many, many teachers that have touched your life and given you keen insights, would you mention maybe one teacher that you just really helped you have new insights?
Wow, there's so many. So many. I think today I will mention Angelica Gerbus, who was in the Department of Dance at Ohio State. I was in modern dance, but I also was so interested in medieval and Renaissance dance since I studied that period a lot. And she, if you've seen any of the historical dramas, like, for example, Elizabeth I with, I forget who was the actor in that, I'm blanking. But anyhow, Angelica was so renowned worldwide for her scholarship regarding Renaissance and medieval dance that she taught so many of the people who went out and also trained a lot of the actors to do these dances in the film. So she was amazing. And so the first important rule about medieval and Renaissance dances, demeanor. And she paid me a huge compliment when she said that I had perfect Renaissance demeanor. Whatever that means.
Well, I think she was addressing your presence. You have such a divine presence, my dear.
Oh, thank you. But so I think why I'm naming her is part of medieval and Renaissance dance is presence, as you're saying, but also understanding stillness, which is just as much a part of movement. When to pause, when to be still. And it's like a spiritual concept too. So I'm going to pay homage to Angelica Gerbus. So she was remarkable.
Let me say thank you so very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
It is a great honor to talk to Ms. Leslie Constable. Such an honor to speak to you.
Thank you, Rick. It was just such a pleasure. Every second.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, that was the amazing Leslie Constable. Misha, you want to say anything about our good friend Noah Levin?
Well, actually, our experience after having listened all this poetry at literary, to add something. Nevertheless, we have a new poet. Now we have a new experience, and we have to be aware that this new experience is completely new and completely different from what we had until now. That means it is something inspired by the street poetry in New York, on one hand, as a as historical experience, and on the other hand, as an aesthetical experience. Let our listeners, our spectators, prepare for this. It is a completely new kind of poetry, nevertheless, equally profound and complex one.
Thank you very much, my friend. Here we go, Noah Levin. How are you, my friend?
I'm all right. How about yourself?
Splendid, splendid. It's been a marvelous, exciting weekend, and I had the pleasure of interviewing Leslie Constable earlier today.
Oh, cool.
What a marvelous, marvelous poet and human being. Just an amazing person. As I anticipate you being the same sort of thing. You struck me from the first time I saw your brother as a man of humor, a man of intellect, and a man of spiritual depth. Well, go ahead.
I really pulled one over on you. That's
yeah?
Terrific.
Prove me wrong. Go ahead.
Oh, I look forward to it. You know, I look forward to afterwards, just sitting there with your head and your hands nodding, like, what did I do? What did I invite?
The way I usually like to start these is to say, ladies and gentlemen, I've had the great good fortune to hear this poet read his work several times. I've always found him to be a poet of depth, a poet of humor. Let me introduce you, Noah Levin. Noah, welcome.
Greetings. How are you?
I'm very well, sir. You know, Poets of the East is designed so that we get a chance to hear not just some poetry of these fine poets, but a little about how they got started, how they started writing, when they realized they didn't have a choice, or however you like to frame it. But, you know, I believe that poets, really, it's a calling. You know, you're a poet because you don't have a choice. And tell me, when was it that you learned that you had to be a writer, you had to be a poet?
Oh, man, you know, I think my first moment really was probably in high school. I mean, the same as probably a lot of us, you know, you're sitting there and you're facing, you know, you're being told to look at different books and write exams. And as I was being exposed to different poetry when I was 15 or so, you know, I remember thinking about going home going, you know, I think I can do this. It was just something like it rhythmically clicked in my head as if, you know, you just stuck your finger in an electric socket and felt that surge. And then just from there, you know, just started writing and all that and started doing that. And then later on in life, you know, in my late 20s or so, then hooked up with some friends who are just stunning poets themselves, and none of us were happy with the New York scene. I'm a New York City poet, and born and bred here, you know, the dirt's under my fingernails here.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you know, and just, I remember hearing them and going, oh my God, these guys are really friggin' good. I mean, I've known them for a while, but not like that, and just that was inspiring, and just took it, you know, took it from there and just had to do it. It just kind of presses on you like a finger in the brain.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, there are poets, I would say, of the pen, and there are poets who perform, and some of them are go across, go both ways, if you will. And obviously, you're a poet who does some performance. Were you always comfortable doing performance?
Yeah, you know, I got told I'm a bit of a ham sometimes, which is not, you know, probably not how I am when I'm sitting in the chair, but it was like Johnny Carson, you know. I'm not comparing myself to the great Johnny Carson by any means, but I related where he talked once about how he was uncomfortable sitting at dinner with a couple of people, but then put him in front of a million and he feels relaxed, you know. So for me, yeah, you know, I mean, I always felt the most important thing to me personally is your words on page, right? And if you have that, that's the most important thing. But then from there, it has a voice. And that's what I've always told people is it's like, you know, it'll speak to you what its voice is. And of course, you have your own range. You know, you got your own singing voice, so to speak. And you just take it from there. You just try and get to the heart of it and express it out. But yeah, I mean, I've enjoyed, I've done stuff with like jazz musicians and all that stuff. It's a lot of fun.
Let me ask you this. I have found in my years there are poets who speak to political or social matters and poets who are a little more introspective. I'm guessing that you do both. You both are write introspective work as well as write some social commentary or political message. Is that true?
It's absolutely true. I mean, it's just, so what I've told folks, because I've always believed in trying to, I mean, right now I've been taking a lot of part in the Zoom readings, as you have, as well, and many of us have. But in general, like to me, I love that moment when creating that moment for someone who hasn't read before, reads that first time and watching that. What I tell people when I can build an area for them to do that is just to write from the heart. And I know that sounds generic, but the truth is whatever's in there is the right thing. So for me, if it's, you know, maybe one day I'm pissed about politics, you know, I have a poem about just enjoying eating in a diner, you know. I mean, it's just that, you know, and if you look at that original poem, you'll see grease from a burger that I was eating. It's just about what strikes you as true. It's not, and what I tell everybody, it's not about necessarily the quality of your work, but if you do it something you believe in, regardless of the theme, you know, then it's beautiful to stay true.
Another question I always enjoy asking is some poets write all the time just for practice. Some feel that unless they're compelled by spirit to write, in other words, that when that spark of inspiration hits, then they write. Where do you fall in that spectrum?
Probably the latter. I really envy people in the first ones. I wish they'd take me to some kind of boot camp. you know, really show me. Like the few times I've done stuff where it necessitated my regular writing, that was terrific. But then at the same time, I almost leaned on that like a crutch. So once that went away, I think I lost all inspiration for like a few years. It was horrible. But that's just me. I do it. Tends to be when I'm when I have some inspiration, but don't forget the valuable moment of a looming deadline is very
very very much so.
A lot of creativity.
One of my real favorite writers, more in the short story vein and in the poetry vein, is a fellow named Italo Calvino. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. He writes really short stories. In fact, he has a claim that he has written the very shortest short story ever written. It's a one-liner. He woke up, and the dinosaur was still there. That's it. But I took some advice of his. He says, you know, write every day. When inspiration comes, then you'll be more prepared. And in fact, he suggests an exercise where you take the simplest, most mundane activity and write about it. And because that's something you have no fear of showing to anybody. You're gonna write about this thing, and you're not gonna show it to anybody. So you can really just either be the descriptive or the colorful impressionistic writer that you are, and just, you know, dive at it. And I had the funny experience. Right after I read that, I said, okay, the next thing I do, whatever it is, I'm gonna write about it. And the next thing on my list was I had to gather the recyclables. So I wrote this narrative, ended up being almost a 10-pager, on collecting the paper products, the can products, the glass products, bundling them up, taking them out to the side of the road. And I ended up being so happy with what happened that I did end up sharing it. So, there you go. Best rules are broken.
I think 5 cents for each of my poem, you know, get the average recycling rate on them. I'll be well, I guess I'll have a couple of dollars.
There you go. Well, listen, if you were going to speak to a young writer someone not quite sure of their own voice, not quite sure if, you know, they can stand shoulder to shoulder with those battle-scarred poets like ourselves. What advice do you have for them?
Well, I mean, you know, one, we've all been that young writer, right? So that's, that's nature for you. We all got to start somewhere, but truthfully, I just tell them to just be themselves and just do it, you know? I mean, if they're standing in front of me, I'm just like, you know, you don't have to worry about, am I really the person you're worried to impress? You know, you tell you about the 20 things I messed up this week, you know?
Yeah.
But truthfully, just do it and enjoy it. Very simple. And like I was saying before, if you've written something and it's from your heart, you know, I think it's beautiful. I've heard so many poets who are very talented but don't necessarily have a voice, you know, like they don't, like it's not, it's a veneer, you know. You look like, you feel like you're looking at a good paint job on a house somewhere. And that's what's important. You got that good foundation, go out there and do it.
Noah, before we get into hearing some of your fine work, I've got to ask you one of my new favorite questions. What is the most unusual presentation of your poetry you participated in? Most unusual setting? Because we've all done some pretty bizarre stuff.
Oh, man, I've had some crazy ones. That's a... the first couple of years, so I ran a poetry group called the Buffalo Readings, or I co-ran it, for about 12, 13 years. We're a New York-based poetry collective, I guess is the only way I can call it.
Sure, sure.
Where we brought on a lot of different folks. And the first 3 years, we were up in a place called Casa del Sol, which was in the Bronx. We do regular monthly readings. I mean, this was in Mott Haven in the Bronx. It was a really bad neighborhood. And the building itself was a abandoned squat. We used to have this is really at our roots, so we had, like, literally for heat, we had, like, a giant tin drum that we'd put fire in. The guy who ran the place, his name was Rafael Bueno, and he actually was responsible for the squat movement in New York City. And
wow.
One of the main leaders of that, and we were really blessed to have him in our group, and he used to run this kind of cultural collective there. And it got into big fights in the city about trying to keep that building. I mean, he'd kept it for about 18, 20 years, right down to closing down the expressway nearby in protest and stuff.
Wow,
like that.
Good for
that
you.
That place was just wild. You know, we had there was no doorbell. It was fenced off. We had one guy who was a fan. He used to guard it with a dog and a gun. that up. And, we went for a couple of years, and that place was nuts. It was just one day I was talking to a friend of mine. He's like, oh, yeah, Bueno's got a whole room full of tuxedos upstairs. And I'm like, well, where did he get a room full of tuxedos? And goes, like, well, he traded a canoe for it. And I go, no, this is in the Bronx, right? You know, I'm talking out in the wild somewhere. He's like, well, he traded a canoe for it. I'm like, well, he traded a canoe? And my friend's like, yeah, he had three of them. And then I just dropped in. That was Casa del Sol. It eventually got closed down by the police and had a, like, 4-alarm fire that was in the news. 16 firemen got hurt. It was pretty crazy.
Oh, my. Yeah.
But, yeah, so I'd probably list that one. I could probably talk for a few hours about that spot.
So, tell me, sir, would you be kind enough to read a few of your fine poems for us?
Absolutely. Let me just reach across to my pile of poetry over here.
Excellent.
What are we going to do today? I'm going to do... Well, you know, I was just talking about Buffalo, so I'm going to start with this one. So this was... like I said, I ran this group, Buffalo Readings. At a certain point, we kind of expanded to the West Coast and started hooking up with, like, jazz bands and all this stuff. So when we first expanded to the West Coast, I wrote this as a blessing to them, but instead I kind of use it a bit as a kind of an intro prayer, if you will. One thing about Buffalo is we used to shout, Buffalo would actually shout Buffalo, so you'll hear that in the poems. So don't, you know, for all of you listening to the speaker, don't lose your... this is called Dedication of the West Coast Buffalo. 3,000 miles may separate, but the spirit is immeasurable by length of land, although created in the gleam of the fires of the Bronx that warmed our bodies but inflamed our gasoline-laden souls. But the match has sparked in the distance in the lands 3 hours before now. So stand strong amongst the herd, because the others are a bunch of sightless bastards that we buffalo unite against in our loathing, even as their fire emits the night's darkness in a way that flickers shadows of soulless nothing even in front of those who have sight. Lead the charge in the land that faces the other way to its ocean, but yet face the correct way, every way, for all things of the spiritual warrior, and lay low the naysayers who do not and will not understand until a candy Teflon coating composes everything we must digest. I like my poison with vinegar because it makes me stronger, and I'll stare down the fool who gave it to me till I lay dead on the earth that conceived me. Our spirits unite as our blood keeps us individuals. Buffalo!
Excellent. Well, I have to recommend one of my short stories to you, a short story called Cow Victory. And I'm not going to tell you any more than that. I'm going to send it to you. I think as a spirit of the buffalo, you will appreciate it. How about another, sir?
Sure. Let's do this poem that is buried in my pile, so all you listeners can hear shuffling of paper. Ah, here you are. So this was, way back in 2007, we got asked to be the featured poets on the Oxford University Press blog for April, not April, that's not a word, for April Poetry, National Poetry Month. And then they asked us back a little bit later and made us like featured poets for about 6 months or a year or something. So this got put on there for that. This is called Fairy Tale of Reality. Pages told as childhood goes, imagination was adrift. Forever tomorrow like eternal timeline drawn in sand, dared across attitude the only challenge to face. Fairy tale reality with truth and future. Possibilities roamed free as mind, but the clock ticked and secretly stole from flesh. Clock bleeds with each stroke as crush of hand became harder to bear. Chapter piled upon chapter, but wish dream could still be reality as mind still sailed on open sea. Tick tock goes mind. Tick, tick, tick. Tick goes wasted effort. Tock goes more to dream. Onward, onward. But the hand on the clock welcomed in new reality. Stronger reality as fled dreams fell from clock. Pages ripped asunder, floating in sea of lost dreams, slowly dripping. Dripping. The wheel of reality crushed mind. Gears grind. Clock ticks. System in place. The book was a lie. Reality was set in stone and ambition adrift. The clock bleeds until sea of dreams claims souls and ship of hope is fool's way out. Book under arm. Book held high. Staring at clock, I see it was created by a thousand minds. Shriveled thoughts imagined into reality. Ticking together, nightmares born to regulate and steal souls to keep mass weathered flesh together. Arms were, pace set in stone, movement steel forward, eyesight stolen, gray is the only normality. Wither in flesh, wither in mind, clockwork patter, it was all still written. Souls sucked into time construct to strengthen the dreary many. Tick pace, time lag behind in march, down road conquering high. A shout is heard, all hands to the ship. Control the wheel, set course, set sail, set mind, set depth, set keels in place. Mutiny your own destiny, sail on through the clock. Shatter the arms and mired parts until shattered gears stand at odds. The parts lay in waste and tick-tock will not wince. Chapter still pile high, weighing down on sharpened mind creates new weave. Supposed ship adrift is now at helm, and book under arm remains guide to dreams. Sail on now with clock in proper place, and northern sky, star and sky above, and withered mind no longer toll to pay. Sail on! Sail on!
I'm sorry about that. Beautiful. I really enjoyed that. You deliver with a passion that is beautiful, my friend. Really, very nice. And
just a piece of me.
Listen, may I offer you one in somewhat of that same vein, okay?
I would both love and be honored by that.
Sir, Let me share one that came to mind from this, that lovely piece you just gave me. I write a lot of, I'm going to say, socially oriented pieces. So let me try this one here for you. I think you might appreciate it. Let's see here. There's a feistiness to your voice, brother, that just really, it's a beautiful thing. Okay, this is written, if you can, and I know you can, if you can remember back to the glory days of George W. Bush.
Oh, I can.
And that incredible reach for justice that they call Homeland Security.
Oh, God, yeah.
So I wrote this little piece that I call Homeland Defense. Ah, to the Vaterland, right? Okay. Between the kings of Saudi oil, whose Shell and Exxon dare not despoil, and those of Wall Street's fiscal toil, where betting against a working man guarantees a stock's demand, and Desert Prince with generous eye holds courts in tents, where gas station cards shall pay the rent. Does the oily hand of GH's show? The old CIA man still in control? Pass the ID cards, but not a fakin', this way from true American icon shaken. Your face will now be pre-recorded, and all your flights will now be boarded. Arm the pilot and the stewardess too. Next to the pillow and the barf bags fun, all passengers now will be issued guns. Ah, for a shootout in the airy blue, oh, what just a day can do. I picture the Stewie, tray in her hand, confronted by the wanted man, tosses the tray into his face, spins on her arm and kicks him trace. He rolls across the cart to a Boy Scout troop who truss him up and steal his boots. His arms behind his back now tied, they bounce him over to the choir side, who pummel, pillage, then retire. And all those who were watching were inspired. And a group of civitan ask for a few fingers from his hand, but the brownie troop wants his bushy beard. You should have heard the things I heard. But then an old monk, Jesuit, gives him quite a goodly kick, and the secretary gets him with her bick. Though the pilot and co-pilot were vying for priority, they submitted their decision to the vote of the majority. Some wanted to toss him right out the door, but a cloister of nuns still wanted some fun. They dragged him back to the airplane's tail, and a rugby team ran him back to the gale. Up to the galley where they banged his head two or three times on the oven's lid, and a group of congressional aides in first class pulled every hair from out of his ass. A covey of comedians dove right in with a left and a right to his nose and his chin, and a group of traitors down from Duluth pushed him and mashed him into the roof, and the ceiling tiles and the overhead bin broke when they tried to stuff him in. But let this be remembered and never forget. Don't ever wait till your library book's late.
Awesome, man. I hope all you at home or wherever you are applauding. Unless you're driving, then just like tap your left foot.
Ha ha. Okay. How about another Noah?
Well, before I do, just a quick question. So I got to ask you, you know, put on my own interview hat, you know. So in the O's, as I like to call them, when GW Jr. was president, I found, at least in New York City, not a lot of people were doing political poetry. I mean, I was, and I have like 20 pounds of complacent poetry. And when I say complacent, like screaming about the complacency of America, which I can't really, I don't read now because it's just not true, or the opposite. The pendulum has flown in the other direction, thankfully, and I feel people are have really noticed what's happening in the world now. But was that your experience where you are? Did you find that there wasn't, I mean, not to say nobody, but that it was not too much? People were, you had.
Oh, absolutely.
Type, but.
My experience. I've been writing radical poetry since the anti-war Vietnam days. So I've been around for a while, and you're absolutely right. I mean, almost everybody, if they thought about it, they were kind of like, let me, you know, God. And I was among the very few poets from Homestead to Miami, to Fort Lauderdale, to Hollywood, to West Palm Beach. I was one of the very, very few doing it. And what's worse, what other great sin that I myself always commit is that my muse works in rhyme.
Hey.
And I was told early on, you know, Rick, now you know that rhyming is passé. And I said, you know what? If my muse says rhyme, by God, I'm going to rhyme. And if it doesn't, and it doesn't always, then I don't. But I have to follow my muse. That's all I can do.
Absolutely. You know, there's no people who go, oh, you know, poetry isn't this, poetry isn't that. You know, it was like in the 90s, there we go, oh, rock music is dead. It's all grunge now. It's like, well, grunge is rock, you know. So, you know, so it's metal, so it's punk, so it's all of it. You know, and all that's got its roots back in the blues. And you know, and poetry, it's just, you, yeah, do it from your heart. I don't rhyme because I'm a horrible rhymer. Nobody wants to hear me rhyme. I'll start sounding like a bad limerick, you know. And you know, you do. I sit there and I go, oh, man, that's great. I wish I could do that. You know, thank you.
How about some more Noah?
Sure. Is a longer piece okay?
Please, sure. Absolutely.
So this piece, I've missed it a lot, you know, because it's too long to read, in Zoom open mics and whatnot.
Not too long here.
Bless you, you know. So this is in five parts. I think I read the first part recently. I started dusted off, so it's been a while since I read it. So let's see. Hopefully I can keep up with it. This is called Consumer Nation. One, consumption. Gray syndrome whose towers and concrete spires and rectangular bleak formation till and pockmark foundation, supporting the structure of the great machine beast whose heart of fire turns us all on its great conveyor belt of uniformity. Desire the same, but the machine beast's belly is composed of unquenchable fire. In the clank of the machine, they create the product beat in a uniform pattern. You can lay your ear to the ground to hear the pulse. 9 to 5 and parts mailed in as businesses sell to businesses and sweat and dirt of grime knuckle plaza lane to the cashier as the great conveyor belt that is the beast tongue pulls us in line for what we must have. I once found my happiness in a bag and I looked over the masses lined up waiting for the parcel as we all in unison bowed down on our knees to the metalwork of dulled landscape that lay in symbolic temples, to the mass consumption and life cycles that lay in the waste of generations, hinges on the axis of that great pounding heartbeat of the machine beast that you can hear when you lay your ear to the temple of the factory that pounds, to get, to salivate, to want, to buy. Oh, you must buy. Consume. You must consume as your knees dig deep upon the structure that keeps it all afloat, that keeps the beast moving, that underlies our great motivation, desire, and all burning consumption. Neon signs blind the eye, and Pavlov says, you want now. Don't look down. Look at what hinges next on the conveyor, and wars late will lay waste to those who clamor to provide to our insatiable thirst. Happiness is a stuffed pig waiting for slaughter. True. Discarded. Unwanted and no longer needed, the beast has disposed of its toys and mounds of forgotten shit that is piled high but out of sight of our direct eye. And we ignore. We ignore as we feed the shit to our forgotten elements, the understructure of the great walking beast who eats its own feces and leaves rotting, rusted testaments to our desire that has moved onward. Scratch strewn in eyesores is a necessary evil that will only be retaken by nature itself as it retakes everything and decay becomes the prize for all things once precious. Entropy is the destiny of everything your eyesight can see, and anyone who says otherwise is a fool, even as he thumbs the ticket that lays open face in the hand waiting for the inevitable end. One for one odds and dust is our ultimate destiny because the universe specializes in waste management. And one day we will be nothing more than debris waiting with open arms to become one again with the thing that birthed us all. Consumed. 3. Aristocracy. Sitting atop the great machine beast, controlling the greed in the same way that we are controlled by it. We dull it out and we eat it. Great cities sitting in the center of all roads leading inward and precious few sit high above, broadcasting the commercial drug that says we all want the beast wares, to help it move on, to help push history to its zenith, to help saturate ourselves. Sit on top of the throne and from a long way down you can't even see how the product falls off the conveyor. But we are the greed. We are the must-have. We are the thought. We are the message. We are the billboard that brainwashes. And we bound lies in servitude and bleed dreams. But if you buy it, the throne can grow a little higher on the product of useless crap that we all must have. We will never ask, where did this come from? Because the damning answer might make us look outside the society box and questioning leads to destruction of what was, when the knowledge says this doesn't have to be, and the thrones we sit upon are transparent when the only real judge of a man is the substance he is composed of. Because greed is shallow and a throne is only as paper thin as the substance it's built upon. Wouldn't you hate to not want ever again? 4. Propaganda. Salivation rules my dreams and nighttime nightmares alike. It says, stay satiated. It's how it must be. It's how it always was. It's how it always should be. It's for the best. This is all for the best. Don't question and don't ask. We should never betray the almighty beast because despite your possible personal misery, this is the moment history has led to. The divine utopian moment, and you should admire the billboard signs as you're riding the conveyor belt tongue waiting to be devoured. Pick and choose what you want. Ride the glue that holds the beast together as we all sit happy and fat in our own swill. And we will chant, everything is fine. 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 Be proud to be part of the machine beast. Plug your head in as you ride the conveyor and listen to the dull hum that sends spittle down your cheeks saying, we're the greatest. And while you're feeling happy and satisfied today, why don't you go out and buy one of our fine products? And would you kindly please turn your head as we sell the fine wares of the special interests who happen to tell you how the world works? If you're not questioning it, your opinion no longer matters as long as you are as happy as the last fool to be consumed. Help the structure. Help the beast keep walking and eating and shitting, and you'll be a happy and productive little fool. The beast is in collusion with itself. 5. Epitaphs. The ending is here and has been since the start because the great machine beast, our great walking construction of greed with conveyor belt arms and conveyor belt tongue with eyes and mouth of flames and all-consuming belly, has been gorging and growing fat on itself as plumes of toxic debris smoke billow skyward out of the top of the beast factory smokestack laden head. We are the beast and we will happily consume ourselves to have more. And the ending. I see the ending. Monumental collapse and sorrow replaced with self-loathing and pity. Tools to build a new grand beast. When history comes with its inevitable spear, I doubt our future because this is what we want. To be docile and sit as fat, stuffed pigs building dreams of orgasmic size. Wallow in your fucking filth. But I can't stop questioning, and I hope it's not just me. I know it's not just me. Ask questions inward and ask yourself what it is that composes your soul. What do you want out of happiness and what do you expect to use to feed and fan those flames of nourishment higher? All roads lead inward, which is why karma is still harvested by anything you feel like sowing. A different viewpoint is sometimes all that's needed to wash away the mind fuck of deceit that lies its way into the fabrics of reality. Destroy the foundation and down with the beast. What's the point of anything if we can't strive to be better?
Beautiful, brother. Beautiful.
Thank you.
If you'll suffer a little more praise, positively Whitman-esque, my brother.
Oh, man, wow. Whitman is one of my later-day heroes. Later-day because I didn't read him until a little bit later, but yeah.
Sure. Beautiful.
He's brilliant.
Yeah,
how about another Noah?
Sure. This one. You know, just to comment what you're saying, you know, it's... you know, what I ask from people, or just, I guess, what I like to hear from people, really, it's not my right to demand people have a thing, but it's, you know, whether you agree with me or don't is irrelevant, you know, just think things out on a one, as each item comes up, you look into it, and you try and figure it out, and then from there, you know, we all do our best, and to me, I love hearing from somebody who has a 180 opinion from me. Because I will probably walk away having learned something because I'd like to listen. And I hope the same to them.
That is wisdom, my brother. Great wisdom.
Well, you know, and I heard some of that in your piece. So, you know, let's do, keep on the same topic. Let's do this. This is Ununited State. I wrote this back in like October, I think, or something like that. Decayed soil ripples under serpent tongue current.
History books tried to fertilize land, but plague took hold from leaders' mouth and radio broadcast parroted message to followers sitting in living rooms wanting to just pay bills and live life like you and I. Snake oil structure system collapsed. Friend at throat of friend. Follow Pied Piper into the abyss. No longer hearing or wanting to know. Hatred divides while powerful reap on investment of your fears. Saying every life matters while they do, but should never be an excuse to steal the rights of black lives of marginalized. Change the laws and steal basic humanity on gender. Stare into the eyes of chaos and vote for your chosen propaganda. Drink fat, swill, and swallow. I saw the doctor today, and she said I had a disease of mind reading too much online. Decayed thoughts, paralyzed independence. Read Tolstoy and call me in the morning. Nexus node, litter carriers slog through current turmoil. Where's my mail? Lost to political machinations and greed, subservient pledges of unholy dollars, rip infrastructure and white-knuckled power, mad refuses to lose control. Watch it come tumbling down while toasting our very thoughts with fealty pledge to talking heads who promise a better future and suck soul tears of dreams of future and happiness. Safetiness is a bargaining chip of those that gain. Live life in fear. Over the horizon, the illusionary enemy allows flank attack of those that pull the strings. It's not that hard. Promises of food on the table, a hard day's work offered, and health of family. Freedom to live for you and I. Enemy holds cudgel overhead and protects power treasured hoard. Swear loyalty and smile will right the rift asunder in exchange for hollowed promises. Checkmate, you lose. Swallowed by a two-party delirium, George Washington said would devour our country whole. I love you all.
Thank you so much, my friend. That has been wonderful. Really wonderful.
Thank you so much for giving me this platform and giving many poets this platform. You know?
Sir, you speak powerfully and wisely, and for that I thank you. As a brother poet, I salute you, my friend.
I greatly appreciate it. You know, if I'm down in Florida, I'm going to have to come knocking and throw a few back.
Well, these days, I hang my studio in another place. I'm in Tennessee these days.
Oh, right on. That's, it's funny in the Zoom era, I find 90% of poets I stumble across always from Tennessee or the UK. It's really quite fascinating. I mean, and globally, but that's the concentration. I had no idea Tennessee had such a poet scene.
Well, I'm a brand new refugee transplant. COVID and the incredible nihilistic government of Florida drove me away from there. I'd been down there for 40 years. And
oh, wow.
I saw that environment just destroyed. Corporations own the government. They own the scientists that cover up the problems. And I have videotape of, because I'm an environmental-oriented person, I produced a news show for 10 years, and I've got all this videotape of the lies and lies and lies and lies. And last year it got so bad, they had to close the ocean, my brother. They had to close the ocean.
You know, if the ocean isn't a public right, I really just don't know what it is. You got ocean, you've got land, and you've got atmosphere.
I tracked down the senior scientist from Florida Fish and Wildlife, ostensibly the guy responsible for guaranteeing the quality of Florida waters, not just for people, because there are other important beings besides people. But you know what he said to me? He said he wouldn't eat a fish from Florida waters, fresh or salt. He said that there's only one fish that's safe to eat, what they call dolphin or dorado or mahi-mahi sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
And he said because all the famous game fish, you know, the snapper, the grouper, and all that jazz, they're top of the food chain predators. They've been bioaccumulating all that poison. They've destroyed Lake Okeechobee, the largest lake. They've destroyed it. It is simultaneously toxic, and people are still fishing in it because they're subsistence fishermen.
You know, it just it makes my heart hurt. You know, it's I've always said one of the most important things that could pass. I mean, they had a law for this, which is campaign finance reform. I remember back in 2000 when in the presidential campaign, you might remember this, when John McCain and I'm forgetting the other gentleman's name, Senator Byrd, he was a famous basketball player,
who I'm referring to.
They got together. One was a hardcore Democrat. The other was a hardcore Republican. They got together and they went on to camera and said, well, you know, campaign finance reform is the most important thing. And as such, we're getting together as two presidential candidates from opposite tickets to pledge that, you know, this needs to be fought. And McCain certainly, you know, although I've certainly disagreed with all of McCain's politics over the years, he really went after that. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court turned it over. What you have with campaign finance and also lobbying is effectively legalized bribery.
Yeah.
Is the only way I can refer to it.
Yeah.
And when this country was created, you did not have these massive country-sized companies, you know, who are more powerful.
They're tax-free.
They're tax-free. And they have some, you know, and they have the power more power than smaller countries. And they're able to just legally buy these politicians on the left and the right. None of them are, you know, why would a politician work for a poor man or woman? I can't give them millions of dollars.
They work for their paymasters, for sure.
Yeah, you know. And then you see them, so they broadcast, you know, like, oh, yeah, you know, don't you want to buy this today?
Well, your consumer piece is absolutely fabulous.
Oh, thank you.
I hope you published it.
I think I published it on my own website years and years and years ago, which is, you know, since slightly deceased that site. But
it's
yeah,
good stuff. Listen, I need to say farewell. I want to thank you so much, my brother, for your marvelous, marvelous work. Thank you for spending some time with us.
Well, thank you so much. Is it okay if I quickly plug a couple of things I have?
Please do. Please do.
You know, I'm so bad at plugging things. I actually had to write it down just so I would remember. I was sitting in front of me. I used to hit the stage and forget to say my own name. I'm serious. And I had my other posts start screaming at me, plug our things. So a lot of us on Zoom are going to be part of a terrific movie that Finn Hall is putting together, which is A Desolation of Poets. That's coming out to a YouTube near you, I think, in about 2 weeks.
Excellent.
Really honored to be part of. And then I personally have two projects that I'm working on that I'm excited for. One is called The Sun Poem, and that is something I launched with a fellow poet, Mia Hansford, back in 2019, where what we did was went to the New York Poetry Festival, and we set up as a vendor. And what we did is we told everybody, here, come write or draw something about the sun. We set up, like, all these art and writing supplies and all that. And then we created a giant sculpture out of it. The idea was, you know, a lot of poets, at least in the New York scene, they're kind of full of themselves. Everybody's walking around like, oh, I'm going to read. And then you get these people who, you know, some are maybe terrific poets, some maybe have never written before. And it's like, no, I want you to be a part of this. So with the pandemic, it closed down. Obviously, after we had our first successful run, so we're looking to bring it back to this year's poetry festival. And one thing I was thinking about was looking at the different great Zoom artists out there internationally, being like, hey, you know, maybe you can send me your poems or art, and then we'll actually like put it up. I think we're talking maybe about creating like Tibetan flags out of it, the prayer flags.
Nice, nice.
And then we're going to get a spot in New York to host it. So that's one thing. I'm excited to bring that back. And then the other is my former Buffalo poet, Roger Kenny, who I used to run Buffalo with, along with a few others. He has created a virtual reality art gallery.
Wow.
It's all in VR. He launched it very recently. It's called The Road Gallery. So me and him are looking to start a new poetry series there. So it'll be all in virtual reality. Whole thing. We'll also make sure that folks who don't have, you know, those crazy goggles and whatnot, because I don't have those either, can just sit at their desktop. And so folks will hear more about that from me, asking people to come and participate. And I think it should be cool and different. So I'm very excited for those two things.
So is there an email or a web address we should go to for more information?
Not yet. I'll be announcing it on my Facebook. And then I'm still looking to, some of that stuff is a little nebulous.
Future,
it's not direct,
future,
but
it's still future.
Well,
yeah.
It's coming up soon, but it's happening. So you'll see stuff. For the Sun Poem, we have an Instagram, which is, I think, it's just the Sun Poem.
Okay.
So you'll find it there, which is, you'll see the art from 2 years ago, and then I'll be posting links sometime soon.
Well, thank you again, my brother. It's been a very much an honor to join you.
Absolutely. It was an honor to be part of this, man, and thank you for letting me blab on.
An honor. You take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.
It's been wonderful having you with us. We'll see you again next week. Thanks again, and tune in again for more Poets of the East, where we bring you the finest poets from across the globe. Thanks again, Rick Spisak. And on behalf of myself and my good friend, Misha Danduta, want to wish you a wonderful week ahead. Remember, you can listen anytime. Please share the link with your friends so that all the good poets can hear these amazing voices. Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
I'm going to go back to the chair. I'm going to go back to the chair.